Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. This week, your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra takes on a distinctly Russian accent with an American piece inspired by Russia and two Russian masters. Here to translate are James Fedek, our guest conductor. Welcome back, James.
Thank you.
And our pianist, Natasha Peremsky. Natasha, welcome.
Thank you.
So we have this work that we'll talk about first, and that's Sean Shepard's piece, and then we'll have a little discussion about the Tchaikovsky and the Rachmaninoff after that. It's a tale of three works. One's unknown, one is wildly loved, and one is sorely neglected, and they're all Russian. So we start with the unknown, because I think starting with the unknown is always the most fun. Sean Shepard's Magia, which was written for the National Youth Orchestra. Tell me about this piece, James.
Well, Sean Shepard can speak about it much more eloquently than I, perhaps. But what I understand in his concept about this work is really he tried to capture the idea and the spirit that exists in Russian stories, fantasy, folklore, literature. Of course, he's a great tradition of this kind of thing from Russia, and so. In the music, we find this really incredible lightness and fantasy, and it's sort of one idea spins out from another. And it's actually a great way to open this concert, because here's a piece by an American composer, one could say up-and-coming American composer, major composer, terrific composer, nice guy. I've known Sean for several years now. And so we have this American and this Russian sort of combination in the first piece, and something that is a thread throughout the entire program.
The Russian culture as viewed through an American eyeglass.
Yes.
This was written for the National Youth Orchestra for their big tour. Is it a kids' piece?
I don't think necessarily. I mean, the inaugural season of the National Youth Orchestra in this country was a pretty major project. And by all accounts, I wasn't at the concerts, but by all accounts, it was a pretty professional, significant level. And certainly they had Valery Gergiev conducting. And so that was certainly part of, I think, why Sean took this angle to the work.
I hear Gergiev is pretty professional from time to time. So you have this piece that is inspired by magic and by fairy tales and Russian fairy tales. Was this one of your picks? Did you choose this to put it on the program?
Actually, this is a mysterious thing about how concerts come together. But in this case, I'm fairly certain this program, as I recall, the program was already determined, and somehow. And I said, okay, well, I'll take that on. I'll do that. So previously, in all honesty, I was not aware of this particular work of Sean Shepard, although I know several of his other pieces.
So when you got this piece, how do you go about working with a piece you've never played before?
Well, I try to get an understanding of what is the spirit of the piece. What is the composer trying to create? What is the overall story and idea, and then I look for ways that I can highlight that, sort of working from the big picture down to the details and then back out to the big picture again. And I find that's, whether it's a contemporary work hot off the presses or an old warhorse, as it were, that for me is what really helps my imagination the best.
So what is the big picture on this? Because the audience will never have heard this piece before unless we happen to see the National Youth Orchestra in concert. And I have to say, we did have more than one Rochester musician in that particular orchestra playing. So there might be a parent or two out there that's going to know this piece. Other than that, what are we, the rest of us who've never heard this piece, going to expect when we hear this Magia?
Well, it's a piece that really spins out one idea after another very, very quickly. It isn't a piece that has a beautiful, continuous melody, although certainly there's melodic elements to it, but it's a lot of fantasy. It's a lot of imaginative color. And I think if one thinks about it in terms of like a painting, there's a lot of bright, streaks of color rather than, say, a photographic landscape. But these colors are bold and big and thought-provoking. And I think in the few minutes of the piece, I think maybe it's 8 minutes long, 9 minutes, we'll see ultimately how long it will be for us. But it's one color, one big, bold color after another.
Natasha, you were born in Russia.
Indeed.
And do you remember any of it? Because you came over to the States when?
I was 8 years old.
So what do you remember of Russia?
Oh, it was really cold. actually, I my cognizant years were right when Perestroika happened, about 1990, right around there, right around then. And I was born in Moscow. I grew up there until my parents immigrated. And I remember my mom being very, very protective of us. Like, we were not allowed to let go of her arms because it was such a bad time in Russian history. And I remember that. I remember my first piano lesson. I remember all my piano lessons with my teacher. I remember exactly the street. I remember where my school was. I remember a lot of things. I remember getting really sick on the bus, like literally the smell of the bus. And my mom's like, oh, not again. Come on. Please not today. I'm like, I just can't help it.
Do you miss Russia?
You know, that's a very interesting question. It's hard to answer that because the majority of my life has been spent in America. But what I miss is I do miss being in Russia. And I miss having, for example, not to explain certain cultural things, you know, sort of like certain kind of idiosyncrasies that I find myself explaining to my American friends, and they're like, but you're American. I'm like, really quickly, let's just backtrack. And, you know, I was born in Russia. I was raised in a Russian family with Russian traditions. I read a lot of Russian literature growing up, even when I moved to America. And my parents always had Russian friends over. I've seen all the Russian movies. So, you know, it's very easy to say, like, you can take the girl out of Russia, but you can't take Russia out of the girl so quickly.
It's funny, when we talk about Russia, and we were having a discussion about Stalin. They just did Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5, and Shostakovich and Stalin, and Prokofiev. And when things were just so very bad for Shostakovich, Prokofiev chose to go back to Russia. And against many people's advice. But it seems that pull of Russia is so strong.
Yeah, there is definitely that connection to the motherland. You know, I think a lot of that is ingrained in the Russian culture, this kind of deep love, not only for the country, but like for the earth. You know, even when you read these fairy tales, there's like a deep nature connection, the forest, the trees. When you see Russian paintings, it's always like so deeply rooted. And even you read Tolstoy, he's always talking about oak trees. Like, all his metaphors are, you know, like they're deeply rooted in the natural aspect of things. And I think that's because it's such a sprawling country, and much of it is just wilderness. Mm-hmm. And so there's that really serious connection. I mean, everybody who lives in a city has a house in a more remote area called a dacha, and they usually farm. And, you know, my great grandmother was born and died on a farm, had her own farm, like pigs and horses and all this stuff. And there's a very serious connection to the Mother Earth. And also because of the history, there's a deep connection to the culture. And there's, especially after World War II, it's like we have to hold this so dear because it can be taken away at any point. I mean, yeah, there was Napoleon, and there were the Tartar invasions and the Turks. And but yeah, there have been a lot of invasions basically trying to go for the fruitful land. But generally, yes, there's a really big pull, because I think it's very easy to get nostalgic about a beautiful place where there's a very special culture. It's different from many, many, many other cultures. And so you kind of, it's easy to sort of feel on the outside and find yourself explaining things. And even though Prokofiev, when he first, for example, came to New York, he was absolutely smitten with New York, and vice versa. New York was smitten with him, this kind of like very flamboyant personality. And he fell in love with his first wife in New York. And then everybody in New York told him to go to Paris. And he went to Paris, loved Paris. And then like come 1930s, you know, all this crazy stuff starts going down with Stalin. And for some reason, he's like, I just really miss Russia. And they're like, seriously, you have a foreign wife.
Don't go. Don't do that.
You know, please don't go. They will literally, they'll take her, they'll put her in the gulag, and who knows what will happen to you. And that's exactly what happened. And I think that from the time he moved back until his death were his darkest years.
You are playing one of the great Russian.
I'm not playing Prokofiev.
No, but you're playing one of the great Russian piano concertos.
Yes.
And it's the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto Number 1. And it's just about as Russian as it gets, except for maybe the symphony, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. So I ask you, Natasha, about your Tchaikovsky symphony, Piano Concerto Number 1. Why do pianists love this piece?
Do pianists love this piece?
They seem to play it an awful lot.
Yes. Well, actually, I'll tell you, not all pianists love the piece. I had a very strange conversation recently with a pianist who didn't like Russian music at all. I absolutely adore this piece, and I've lived with it for not as long as I will have lived with it when I am, you know, 100 years old, but in my life, it's been the majority of my life. So I've been playing it since I was 13. And I've played it many, many, many times. And, you know, I'm always just stunned by its beauty. It's just so beautiful. And it's so epic. And, you know, it's like a beautiful novel. And then there are all these elements of jazz in it for me. You know, like the second movement, the prestissimo. I mean, that is so like, it's like scatting, really. And then there's like a French chanson, there's a pastoral feeling, and then there's the tripak, the Russian dance, the last movement, quintessentially Russian. And I think that was sort of, I think it's so brilliant to have a Russian dance as the last movement. If you think about it, during that period of history, what other concerto can you think of that would have like such a Slavic theme to it? So it was like kind of bridging the gap between Russia and the West, which at the time was Europe, and America, actually, because this was premiered in America. So here he comes to Boston. Rubinstein rejects the piece. And so he brings it to Boston, and you hear this Russian dance out of nowhere, you know? So it's kind of very unusual, and the beginning is very unusual. So you have to, like, I think for me as a performer, I have to recreate this element of surprise. Of course, Tripak is no longer a surprise to anybody anymore. Thank you, Nutcracker. But, you know, like, the opening is, it's unusual. It's grandiose. There's a cadenza like a minute into the piece.
So let's talk about that opening, because that opening has the big cascade of chords, mm-hmm. The big cascade of chords. It strikes me as a very fine line between bringing it and pounding it.
Yeah. Interesting point. No pound. No pound, as Seinfeld would say. No pound. Here's the thing. I really do not believe that one should pound any moment in this concerto. And in fact, that's why I'm considering switching pianos. Since rehearsal today and for the dress rehearsal tomorrow, because I found that the piano that I chose initially, that I thought was would actually suit this piece very well, in the end I find a bit too aggressive, actually. Because I think, you know what, also, you have to remember, Tchaikovsky loved ballet. He was the first great, truly great ballet writer. And ballet, what can be more elegant? So this piece is elegant. It's grandiose, for sure, yes. And the opening is maestoso, and it's grandiose, and it's this big melody, and yeah, you've got these big chords. But interestingly, the first edition, the original edition of this piece, he had the chords rolled, and they were in piano. So the idea was born out of this kind of very, actually, gentle statement. And then I think it just didn't work in concert. So now, you know, the additions have been changed to play forte, or fortissimo, whatever it is. can't remember now. So I still think that, you know, forte can be a variety of things. It can be an aggressive forte. It can be a sforzando. It can be, like, something jarring. I think this is an elegant forte, just, like, big wingspan kind of forte, as opposed to, like, in your face. So that's why I'm switching pianos, literally, because I felt like I was fighting this.
So what about aggression. You and the orchestra with this piece? Because you have a lot of work to do, James. You're very busy. What is the orchestral writing like for this?
Well, this is a concerto, the first piano concerto of Tchaikovsky. That orchestras know very, very well. It's played frequently every few seasons. And I personally love to do this kind of repertoire that orchestras know so well, because it's really fun to help them realize that there are things on the page that we've all missed, out of just such collective knowledge of we know what it sounds like, so we just sort of play it, oh yeah, it's this part again, and so on. But there must be something more to discover, and that's certainly my approach in this, is to try to bring detail and color to accompany Natasha in such a way that it's a new experience for the orchestra. And part of that, actually, in our rehearsals, it was a very important thing to stress about Tchaikovsky. People have a certain idea of what Tchaikovsky, who he is, what his music sounds like, and so on. And a lot of the concerto is very big, thickly orchestrated, a lot of the brass, full, rich, all this. But actually, one of the things I kept coming back to in the rehearsal was this idea of, it's not just power, but it has to have resonance and beauty and singing and this idea of elegance. And those, for me, are really priorities about this concerto, that the power comes from the beauty of the sound together and the beauty of how the piano and the orchestra work together.
So you are, as Natasha said, trying to find that surprise when you're working with the orchestra, that musical surprise, to go back and find that moment that maybe they've just ridden over for the last 30 years. Where have you found your nicest surprises in this piece?
I think it would be, for myself personally, to really uncover some of the humor in this piece. That it is not just heavy and serious and so on, although it certainly would be that as well at times. But there is a certain other character, which I think performances often miss, which is a bit of wit and humor and that kind of other side of it, which maybe, I don't know, maybe is not so stereotypically Russian, what one would kind of think about Russian music stereotypically.
Oh, sure.
But I...
Love for Three Oranges? I mean, it happens. It's sarcastic, but... I agree with you completely.
I don't know that people, but I guess what I mean is perhaps many people would not immediately think of that with Russian music, although it is very much an element that is there. And that therefore, I think, unfortunately, many performances of this concerto and other standard Russian big pieces tend to be very one-dimensional. So that's, I don't know if you would agree with that, but for me, that's really a priority to expand for the experience, expand the full range of color.
It's sort of, you know, when we think about Russia, which when people talk about Russian music, they think of the big, dark, heavy, breast-beating, serious thing. And what you're both saying to me is that is maybe an element, but it's a lot bigger than that.
Yeah, I have to say that across the board, that is something I find myself actually fighting in a rehearsal, which I didn't have to earlier today, because I felt like, literally, I said to James, I said, it's, you took the thoughts out of my brain and you said them, you know, right out loud, like, let's lighten this up. And I think it's wrong to generalize Russian music, especially composers like Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff, to say, oh, this is going to be soggy. You know, we got to make this big. You know, Prokofiev even, I mean, Shostakovich, I mean, name any Russian composer and I will show you like hours and hours of moments where you have to absolutely lighten it up. Like, for example, the last movement of this concerto. I mean, if you play it heavy, it's not a tripak. As far as I'm concerned, that's not a Russian dance. If you ever watched true Russian folk dancing, like the professional ballets, it is so light. It is like they're always in the air. It's acrobatic. So they're always up. They're always bouncing. You can't bounce if you're, you know, pounding in and digging in your heels, you can't jump. So it's, and I think the lightness creates a lot of this kind of drama and energy that I think would be missing if you just kind of put a lot of weight on it.
Now you said the magic word, Rachmaninoff, which is the third piece of our Russian trilogy. The Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 3 in A minor had a really miserable debut and immediately sunk into obscurity and hasn't fully come out of that closet where it was put.
Well, talk about a composer that people have preconceived notions, Rachmaninoff. One thinks about something like the Second Symphony, the piano concertos, the second, third piano concerto perhaps especially, and those long, singing, endless, gorgeous melodies. And yes, this is a symphony that's melodic and beautiful, but it's also a further evolution of his artistic output and creativity. And in a way, it's, I think, a transitional... I don't want to speak for the composer, but I find and I think of it a bit transitional to what ultimately became another style with the symphonic dances and so on, and particularly coupled with his move to America. Although the symphony predates that, there's a move within him away from what he did before that I sense in this music. Again, I can't speak for the composer. So this third symphony is very different than the second in those ways, but I would like to make the case that it's a piece that should be played a lot more frequently, or perhaps people expect the Second Symphony a lot, so maybe it won't be as much as the Second Symphony, but it's certainly no less well constructed of a piece.
Is it me, when I was listening to this, was it me, or I thought I heard echoes of the symphonic dances in this piece, like actual passages that popped up in a bigger way in the symphonic. Is this true? Did I actually hear that?
It also seems to me there are really, I wouldn't go so far as to say, okay, there's things directly copied out of it, but certainly thematic cells, fragments are, it's brewing in his mind. And again, for me, that makes it clear that this is a work that is definitely creatively transitioning into another kind of idea.
It also struck me that it had some, it's the wrong word, but it's the best I can come up with right now, sort of this impressionist thing that seems to happen in it.
There's a lot more, again, I would say, less melodic emphasis and more emphasis on texture. Texture of and I think in a way maybe more experimentation with orchestration than we find in earlier works.
Yeah, tell us about each of the three movements, if you could, James.
Well, the first movement, the symphony's in three movements, which is perhaps a bit unusual, but the second movement is almost like two movements in one. So it could be four movements, but although it's titled to be three. And in the first movement, I find the first movement is the most like symphonic dances, with little cells of melodic information that gets developed on a small scale, again, rather than big sweeping melodies. The second movement is incredibly graceful and beautiful, and I think that is the most picturesque and intimate, at least in the way it starts, and we do get some of that lush melodic expectation fulfilled. But then it breaks almost unexpectedly into this scherzo, which is almost like another movement, although again it's officially part of the second movement, and it's an immediate change, completely different aesthetic and certainly listening experience, and it's very, very fragmented. It's almost something, again, not to speak for the composer, but it's almost something that is subconscious. There's so many ideas at one time, very fragmented, very much, there is not a sense of orientation, of time and space. It just is stream of consciousness and roaming of ideas, if that makes sense. And then the third moment, the finale, has great lighthearted and dancing, and that also is maybe a bit more characteristically Rachmaninoff, because there's always that bit of a smile in this music. Maybe it's never a full smile, but it always has a bit of that joy does come through. Certainly, most of all in the finale.
Is this why people did not like this the first time they heard it? Because there's always that moment, you know, in the concertos and the symphony, there's always that moment that has that tune line, that melody line, and everybody just goes, and some pop stars here actually make entire songs about them. Is that why people did not like this?
I suppose it could have been. If one knew of Rachmaninoff's music and had a certain expectation, perhaps on first listening as an isolated event in that context, one may not immediately recognize this as fully Rachmaninoff. I don't know if that's really a fair thing to say, but I suppose that expectation may have not been fulfilled by the first hearing.
So what is an artist to do, Natasha? You need to grow. You need to change. You can't stay in the same place for your entire life. Mm-hmm. So what is a composer or an artist to do when you have an audience that demands that beautiful melody and you just are not in a place to deliver it?
You just hit them over the head with it until they're ready for it. No, I think, yeah. I mean, are you asking me as an interpreter? How do you present something that people aren't?
I'm asking you as an artist, because you're going to be changing your repertoire as you go through. What do you do to beat expectation?
You know, you have to actually divorce yourself from all thought of being judged. And it's a really hard thing to do because, I play a lot of Russian concertos in my career. And I actually very purposefully this past season, because I have more control over my solo programs, I don't have a single Russian piece in my solo program. It's all German. And I did that in a way, not to prove something to people, but to kind of, you know, expand my artistic landscape. And, you know, I mean, as great as Russian music is, and, you know, I can play it all day, every day, of course, it's in my blood, blah, 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 all that good stuff. Everybody loves it. You know, Czech one, audiences love it. Great. But I wouldn't really be a complete pianist if all I did was play Russian music. It wouldn't really inform me very well to play Tchaikovsky and not be able to play Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms and Schumann and, you know, and French music, Debussy, and all these composers greatly affected Tchaikovsky also, you know? So you can't just kind of like throw away and just be like, well, people expect me to play Russian music. Well, yes, that's wonderful. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that you almost have to like sometimes fight through people's expectations. And you have to kind of, you know, music is music. And when you're convinced about something, when you have a deep love for a piece of music and you've spent hours and hours and hours with it and years, and you love it to its core, and you, of course, you're always learning and expanding your knowledge of things. But I think that when people see your love for a particular piece, let's just say, you know, a Brahms concerto, I don't think they will right away be like, oh, well, that's just, ugh, you know, I should stick to Russian music. Maybe people will come away and say, oh, she should just stick with Russian music. That's fine, but
you can't. Your career, and
it's
and
not you, even just my career. It's just like my curiosity as an artist goes way beyond, you know, playing all the Prokofiev concertos, all Rachmaninoff concertos, and.
So, is there a concerto that you have your eyes set on, that you have not yet played out, and you have not yet recorded, and yet you want to?
Well, okay. So this is a funny thing. I've actually been asked, my first love of Brahms concertos was the second concerto. That was my, and there are like two camps. It's like Brahms 1 and Brahms 2. Like people who love Brahms 1 and people who prefer Brahms 2.
Jeremy Dank was actually just in town to play the Brahms 1. He was originally slated to play the Brahms 2. Mm. But because of various reasons, he had to play the 1 instead. And there were actually people who were like, now I don't want to go.
Yeah, it's weird. It's really weird. It's like this. Like, any of the Rachmaninoff concertos, except the fourth, people are like, yeah, we're going. Like, it's going to be great. But, for some reason, people are like, it's either Brahms 1 or Brahms 2. And understandably so. They're two very different animals. For me, it was Brahms 2 that was, like, my first love. I was obsessed with it. And I learned it against the advice of my teacher at 14, because I was like, I just want to play this. And I went around beating all these competitions over the head with Brahms 2. And guess what? I only ever get asked to play Brahms 1. And somehow, and I think if you look around, like how many women play Brahms 2, and not to bring up like that there's any sexism involved, but for some reason people somehow think that there's like, it's like a masculine concerto and that Brahms is masculine and all this, that and the other, which I totally disagree with. But I would love the opportunity to play Brahms 2. And I haven't played it once.
It will come.
With a professional orchestra.
It will come. James, you're an organist. So what do you do as an organist to stretch your artistic chops?
Well, I actually had several musical interests and background. In a conservatory, I had three, and then it became four different areas of study.
Piano, oboe,
organ, and then conducting.
Which was the first one that hit the floor? I would guess it would be the oboe.
before I hit the floor, meaning
set it aside.
Well, actually, there was a definite moment when I was called into the dean's office, and he said, "Okay, this is great that you're doing all this, but you're going to be in school about 12 or 15 years, so maybe one should go." And just in terms of looking and spending a lot of time at the looking at the course grids and whatever was possible, the piano I did not finish, but I finished the oboe and the organ and conducting.
That surprised me. I thought for sure it'd be the oboe, didn't you, Natasha?
Actually, I thought it might be piano. No, because I mean, was it the repertoire that was daunting?
Well, it was actually, it was the course requirements.
Yeah.
And frankly speaking, I wanted as broad of a background, because I do have many, many interests, and musical and beyond, to study. But even musically, I had so many, all this going on. I wanted to create for myself a course of study that was very, very broad, and the organ required a great deal of actually score reading, which you would think pianists, I suppose in some programs they have to do it, but you would think pianists would be reading from full orchestral scores if they're going to accompany from and learn all the clefs and so on, but usually they don't, and organists we do, especially the old music is written in these what people like, even current music theorists like to call archaic clefs. And I say, excuse me, we still use them. It's not archaic at all. And the composers, the great composers of the past, didn't think it was archaic. They actually composed using them too. So maybe we should learn them, all seven. But anyway, that's a different story. But for me, I also really loved the orchestra, and the oboe was really the window into that experience. So I could not make a decision, because I really felt, and even what I did to my beloved piano, in terms of not finishing that course of study, it was like betraying a great part of myself. And not to be overly dramatic, but it was a very dark period to decide what's going to happen, because I don't come from a musical family, and I had very encouraging parents, certainly very supportive, but I didn't have, as we say, stage parents saying, okay, you need to just practice the piano, forget all these other curiosities. So it really never occurred to me that I have to specialize. And so conducting was a way to avoid a decision. But I still try to play everything. I still play the organ, the oboe. It's a little harder because of the reed making, but I love to, on the piano, just even sit down and accompany people. And, you know, it's as a conductor, it's very important to me to still play something, because I think without that, conductors can get very cerebral and they lose touch, perhaps very often, with what people making music and directly making sound need.
You are known for stepping in at the last minute and covering for ill maestros. Is there a point in your life where you just want to settle down with your own orchestra, James?
Well, this is a very interesting thing. It's just kind of something that's happened. That there, I don't know, been 12 or 14 or 15 now things stepping in. But it's a very, the relationship of conductor to orchestra, in my view, is a very special relationship. And as a guest, you only, in the best sense, it's a very special relationship, in the best of occasions, when everything is really what it should be, what one hopes it is. And as a guest, you only have 3 days or whatever it may be. Depending on the country, sometimes you have 1 day or 2 days. You have such a short time to form your ideas with a group of people. And yes, certainly I would love to have a more significant role with an orchestra. But in my mind, it must be because this is a very important relationship, it must be the right one.
March is Music in Our Schools Month, and we've been asking musicians about their teachers. And in fact, one of your teachers, David Zinman, gave us a talk to us a little bit about that. You said you remembered your teacher back in Russia, but Natasha, is there a moment with one of your teachers that has particularly stayed with you through your journey at the keyboard?
Yes, actually there are a couple of moments. The first moment when I was kind of jolted out of my, I didn't even know I was in a cage interpretationally, was when Earl Wilde, I studied with Earl Wilde, and they were like these chunks of time. You know, I was still in California, and I went to Columbus, Ohio for a week and had like 5-hour lessons with him every day. And it was wonderful. And he talked most of the time about Stravinsky and his relationships with these great, legendary people. But I just remember when I played, well, of course, Brahms 2 for him, because like I said before, I was hitting everybody over the head with it. And I just remember him, because I was playing everything very literally, and he said, "Oh, no, 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 honey, that will never work in front of an orchestra. Try this." And he changed like a, it's hard to explain over radio, but he just changed the notation ever so slightly in a way that like would pop, for lack of a better word, in front of an orchestra. And all of a sudden I was like, my God, that's right. Like, why are we so married to the score? Like, we're like hovering over it like it's, oh, it's this precious thing, and don't you dare change any notes, or God forbid you change a note. And yes, there are many instances where if you change a note, you change the whole trajectory of a phrase, of a voicing, of a texture, all this, that, and the other. But when the particular notation doesn't serve the purpose of the music, I think there's nothing wrong with going in and kind of amping up or shearing it down. And I took that away. And also, he sat down and he demonstrated this Rachmaninoff phrase for me. And he said, you know, you're playing it this way, and that's nice. I've now heard you play this 3 times, and you've played it exactly the same way all 3 times. But I'm going to show you about 25 ways of looking at this phrase, each of which maybe some you will disagree with, maybe some you like. But he kind of forced me to just try new things and actually work with expression rather than like, I'm playing the notes and now I'm voicing and look at me, like I really studied the structure and now, like, you know, I'm using this pedal here like this, and this is what I've practiced. And it was this like spontaneity that he like squeezed out of me. And it was like, like, wow. I was 15 and it was like, my earth is like shattered. I mean, it was like beautiful. And then the second moment was he kind of inspired a little bit too much wilderness in me. I was like, I could totally get in touch with that side of myself. And I kind of went like kind of spiraled out of control. In a way, like interpretationally, I kind of started taking too many liberties. It was sort of like kind of a wild child.
So who after brought that. You back? Who brought you back?
My teacher at Manus, Pavlina Dokovska. I remember this moment so clearly. She just first lesson was like, here are 5 Mozart sonatas I need you to bring for next week. And I was like, I don't play Mozart. I just want to play Petrushka and like Brahms sonatas. That's all I want to do in life. Like, who cares for Mozart? And I was 16, and she was like, "No, I don't want to hear any of that. Like, I want to hear Mozart. No Mozart, no lesson." And I was like, oh, "Okay, fine." And I didn't practice it at all because I was like, "This is easy. I'll just sight read this." And I went in and I basically sight read a bunch of Mozart for her. And, you know, I'm telling you, Pavlina is arguably one of the nicest, kindest, gentlest people you will ever meet.
Not on that
and
day.
And she just looked, she's sitting there like, and she gave me, like, she ripped me a new one. She was like, you are not only wasting my time, you're wasting your talent, and you were rude to Mozart. I mean, like, and she was like, get out. And don't ever half-ass it again in my studio. Next time you come, you're prepared. If you're not prepared, then you're not playing that day. That's all. But don't you come in here and insult myself and insult your talent and insult Mozart.
So what about you, James? Did you ever insult Mozart?
Well, that's open for debate, I suppose.
But where, because we have to wrap up a little here, but I do want to ask you, is there a piece of advice or something from one of your teachers that you've really managed to hold with yourself?
Well, I owe a great deal to David Zinman, as you had mentioned, and he really helped me a great deal with conducting technique and but especially the psychology of doing this. And I think this is to perform, to be a performer, and to be a classical performer. This is a very special thing where it's very easy to be a target of criticism. Everyone, especially as a conductor, everyone has an opinion. Do they like it? Do they not like it? Usually if they don't like it, they're very vocal about it. And everyone has an opinion. And that's a great thing, and certainly nothing is going to change from people having opinions. But it means that to do this, one has to develop a sense of really self self-security, self-awareness, that for me, I would say it's really the main thing, because the music and the knowledge and the technique and all of this is one thing, but then to give convincing performances where you really are vulnerable to criticism, it's important to be that secure in oneself that these things can roll off of you.
I want to thank you both for coming in and spending time with us. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you, Julia.
And Natasha Peremski, and to James Fettick, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you would like more information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.